content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello and welcome to Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. The Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you'd like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that later in this program. But this program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Now, the library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state, by the way. And if you're not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information about how you can do just that at the end of the program. This time, we're spotlighting some of the most popular books checked out during the months of May and June 2019 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Let's begin with a book called Redemption by David Baldacci. On this one, Detective Amos Decker discovers that a mistake he made as a rookie detective may have led to deadly consequences in the latest Memory Man thriller in Baldacci's number one New York Times bestselling series. Decker is visiting his hometown of Burlington, Ohio, when he's approached by a man named Merrill Hawkins. Now, Hawkins is a convicted murderer. In fact, he's the very first killer that Decker ever put behind bars. But he's innocent, he claims. Now suffering from terminal cancer, it's his dying wish that Decker clear his name. It's unthinkable. The case was open and shut with rock-solid forensic evidence. But then Hawkins later turns up dead with a bullet in his head, and even Decker begins to have doubts. Is it possible that he really did get it wrong all those years ago? Well, Decker's determined to uncover the truth, no matter the personal cost. But solving a case this cold may be impossible, especially when it becomes clear that someone doesn't want the old case reopened. Well, someone who is willing to kill to keep the truth buried and hide a decades-old secret that may have some devastating repercussions. Once again, that book is called Redemption. It sounds like a good one, by the popular author David Baldacci. Now, one of the most popular novels to come out in the last couple of years is a book entitled Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. And this was the first novel for the author, who is, I think, about 70 years old, and it has received notice from around the world. It's been in the top of the booksellers list for, oh gosh, probably 8 months to a year now. Anyway, there's a review that was written recently by a woman named Rachel Rosenblatt. She's a freelance writer and editor living in New York, and it's such a good one that I thought I would cover this particular book with this review by Rachel Rosenblatt. I hope you enjoy it. There's a line towards the end of Where the Crawdads Sing when author Delia Owens appears to send a little wink, a mini apology to her readers, also known as devout fans who've bought more than 1.5 million copies and helped her debut novel climb the bestsellers list, where it's lived for the past 7+ months. I have no way of knowing if she meant it this way, dear reader. I've steered this exquisite tale into a bit of hackneyed territory. But a girl's gotta score a movie deal. But that's how I took it. It comes during the murder trial of protagonist Kia, abandoned as a young girl by her entire family to raise herself in a shack in the depths of an isolated marsh. surrounded by nothing but the pulsing, eloquently rendered, thanks to Owen's considerable gifts, natural world. Well, up until the court case gets going, the reader is immersed in the elements alongside Kia. We see a silent cloud of dragonflies part, feel the sun warm as a blanket, then watch it set under a paintbrush sky. Notice the slate-colored waves of North Carolina's coast. Study a ballet of fireflies. Feel the breathing wet earth. Watch egrets take flight. A line of white flags against the mounting gray clouds. Hear the cicadas squeal against a mean sun. We see Kia forage her surroundings to survive, paw through mud for mussels to sell to a local supplier, using the money to buy grits in town, barefoot in two short bib overalls. Well, to the townsfolk, Kia is the marsh girl, a poor, uneducated freak, willfully living alone in a remote shack. But to Owens and to us, she's a majestic creature in a majestic world. Kia knew the time of the tides in her heart. Owens writes, could find her way home by the stars, knew every feather of an eagle. When Kia discovers poetry at the same time as her first pangs of romantic love, how apt indeed, it's nearly too on the nose. Her whole existence is poetry, delicate and raw. But then the trial starts. Kia's been accused of murdering Chase Andrews, town rich kid and former high school quarterback who'd pursued the Marsh girl as a conquest but ended up falling for her. Here's a quote, "You're gorgeous, free, wild as a dang gale," he tells her. "I wanted to get as close as I could." Meanwhile, hiding the dalliance from his uppity family and multiple lovers, the courtroom scenes are a stark contrast of milieu. No more oak-lined lagoon channels to explore under the stars. Now Kia's world comprises a locked cell, a pro bono lawyer, and a slick prosecutor with damning theories for days. And it's here that Owen's writing, like her protagonist, seems ripped from its comfort zone. Now, don't get me wrong, Owen's crafts a compelling court case with twisty interrogations and loudly overruled objections, all the makings of a good legal drama. But the richness of Kia's inner life, so evocative in earlier chapters, seems absent in the courtroom. For such an astute observer of living things, having spent years mesmerized by the feathers of night herons and mating patterns of bullfrogs, there's little observation of the fresh humanity around her. Sure, there are a few Kia-esque animal hierarchy analogies. The judge Kia sees as an alpha male, her lawyer Tom a powerful buck, the bailiff the lowest-ranking male who depended on his belt hung with glistening pistol to bolster his position. But missing are Kia's musings during the case, her survey of the panel of jurors who hold her fate, her perception of the foreign lawyerly language, having grown up outside any institutional walls, the tension between how an outsider might have imagined a courtroom trial and what it turns out to be. Instead, we see the scenes as we might in a film, dramatic, brisk, dialogue-centric, cleverly interspersed with flashbacks that reveal the stories behind the case's physical evidence, but with all the pesky thoughts and feelings edited out. Kia is checked out during the trial, her eyes and observations withdrawn. And it's here that Owens, as if to acquit herself, to apologize for having earlier gifted us with sprawling, richly metaphored writing that suddenly comes to a halt, offers her meta-wink. The language of the court was, of course, not as poetic as the language of the marsh. "I actually laughed out loud," the reporter says, "when I read the line almost as if it said, 'I'm no John Grisham, but cut me some slack.' Up until now, this book has been freaking gorgeous." Well, and that would be true. In any case, if the courtroom scenes aren't as evocative and immersive as what came before, at least they're compulsively readable, split into quick-cut interactions, and capped by swelling closing arguments that scream out for life as a screenplay. No wonder Reese Witherspoon, who helped rocket Owens up the charts by selecting Crawdads as a Hello Sunshine book club pick, and whose producer Spidey Sense can't resist a twisty murder mystery, Gone Girl, Big Little Lies, and so forth, or Woman Surviving the Elements, like Wild in that story, has snapped up the rights and will be producing the film. Owens, who lives in a remote snow-covered corner of Idaho, surrounded by wildlife, and, as she said, 20 miles of back roads from the closest coffee shop, has been charmingly, incredulously gracious about the whole Hollywood thing. But maybe it would be naive to think she hadn't always had a movie rights endgame in mind. Just as Chekhov famously instructed about dramatic intrigue, if in the first act you have hung a pistol on the wall, then in the following one it should be fired. Well, Owens told BookPage that she majorly reworked the Crawdad structure to include a bomb under the sofa that signals that something more happens in this book. She explained that instead of devoting the first third to Kia's prepubescent self-reliance in the wilderness, she started the novel with Chase Andrews' dead body face up in the swamp. The perfect opening shot. Owens has even crafted her own tagline for the film, a nature-immersed mystery and love story with an ending that you'll never guess and never ever forget. And what a cinematic ending it is. Spoiler alert here. Decades after Kia's acquitted and has lived happily as a successful nature writer in her shack alongside her first love, Tate, she dies, only for Tate to discover in the shack's floorboards evidence that she'd indeed murdered Chase, likely just as the prosecution posited. The Kaiser Soze moment, I admit, seeing it coming, but just as I marveled at Kaiser's diabolical ease, how brazen to leave a trail of clues to presume that even so no one would best him in the end. I felt a satisfactory glee with the Owens twist. The big screen will delight in this made-for-Hollywood moment even more. You can practically hear the haunting score, see the camera pan off Tate's stunned face and over Kia's acres of marshland. The great keepers of secrets. And yet I can't think or can't help but think that the most stunningly evocative aspects of this book, the solo dances between Kia and nature, will be the weakest the film has to offer. How do you capture soulfulness, convey stillness, without boring a modern audience to tears? Meanwhile, the least gorgeous parts, the paint-by-numbers court case and Kia's fish-out-of-the-water trips to town, featuring cruel interactions and pointed 1960 racial tensions, will be heightened and exploited on screen, mind, for Oscar bait. Well, at least I'll be able to count myself among the haughty legions to parrot that time-worn phrase. Yeah, but did you read the book? It's so much better. If you haven't read it all already, or you haven't listened to it already, I know you will enjoy this one. It's called Where the Crawdads Sing, and it's by the new author, Delia Owens. Now let's move on to some of the other books that were so popular in the last couple of months at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Here's one called Neon Prey by John Sanford, and this is a long-standing series by Sanford. Lucas Davenport tracks a prolific serial killer in the new nail-biting number one New York Times bestseller from John Sanford. Here's the plot. Clayton Deese looks like a small-time criminal, muscle for hire, when his loan shark boss needs to teach someone a lesson. Well, now 7 months after a job that went south and landed him in jail, Deese has skipped out on bail, and the U.S. Marshals come looking for him. They don't much care about a low-level guy. It's his boss they want, but Dees might be their best chance to bring down the whole operation. Then they step onto a dirt trail behind Dees's rural Louisiana cabin and find a jungle full of graves. Now Lucas Davenport is on the trail of a serial killer who has been operating for years without notice. His quarry is ruthless and, as Davenport will come to find, full of surprises. That one's called Neon Prey by John Sanford. Next, a book called Wolfpack by C.J. Box. Wyoming game warden Joe Pickett encounters bad behavior on his own turf, only to have the FBI and the Department of Justice ask him to stand down. In this thrilling new novel from the number one New York Times bestseller, C.J. Box. Now, the good news is that Joe Pickett has his job back after his last adventure in The Disappeared. The bad news is that he's come to learn that a drone is killing wildlife, and the drone belongs to a mysterious and wealthy man whose son is dating Joe's own daughter, Lucy. Well, when Joe tries to lay down the rules for the drone operator, he's asked by the FBI and the DOJ to stand down, which only makes him more suspicious. Meanwhile, bodies are piling up in and around Joe's district in shocking numbers. He begins to fear that a pack of four vicious killers working on behalf of the Sinaloa cartel, known as the Wolf Pack, has arrived. Their target seems to be the mystery man and everyone, including Joe, Nate, and others, who is associated with him. Teaming up with a female game warden based on a real person, one of the few female game wardens at work in Wyoming today, by the way, to confront these assassins, Joe finds himself in the most violent and dangerous predicament that he has ever faced. Again, the book is called Wolfpack by C.J. Box. There's another wonderful book that just hit the top 10 on the North Carolina Library for the Blind book list in popularity this past month in June. And so I'm going to read a little bit longer review of this one as well, because I think you would really enjoy it. The book is called The Lost Gutenberg by Margaret Leslie Davis. That's right, referring to the Gutenberg Bible. This is a review by Gabino Iglesias, an author, book reviewer, and a professor who lives in Austin, Texas. And so I'm reading from his perspective now. One of the first things I did, the writer says, when I moved to Austin a decade ago was visit the Gutenberg Bible housed in the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas. Now, as a bibliophile, the importance of that book was not lost on me. However, the impact of Johannes Gutenberg's surviving Bibles as cultural treasures and book collectors' dreams was something I'd ignored. That is no longer the case. Margaret Leslie Davis's The Lost Gutenberg, which traces one Bible's 500-year journey, is an informative, superbly researched book that explores the lives of those who were in contact with the best example of Gutenberg's work. In the world of rare book collecting, a copy of the Gutenberg Bible is the ultimate prize. There are fewer than 50 of them in existence today, and none in better condition than the one known as number 45. In The Lost Gutenberg, Davis meticulously chronicles five centuries in the life of this special copy and those who owned it, starting with what is known of its creation by Gutenberg and passing through the hands of monks, an earl whose life ended in poverty, the heir of the Worcestershire sauce business, and eventually into the hands of Estelle Doheny, the first woman collector to acquire the tome and its last private owner. Davis also shows how number 45 has been at the center of innovation from the moment of its creation to the groundbreaking research performed on it, using the proton beam of a cyclotron to study its ink. The depth of Davis's research cannot be understated. The writing in this book is straightforward and at times even heartbreaking, but outstanding reporting lies at its core. Biographies, academic articles, auction catalogs, letters, in-depth interviews, newspaper and magazine articles, personal papers, and websites are just some of the sources used to create the narrative. However, despite the abundance of information, Davis does a superb job of synthesizing everything into a coherent, enjoyable story. Furthermore, she masterfully places the Bibles in the larger context of history and culture at all times. Here's a quote, "Tracking the whereabouts of the Bibles over time produces a heat map of shifting influence as the books move from the confines of the Catholic Church and into the libraries of Europe's aristocrats, and then flow to Britain's empire builders, embellishing the reputations of each successive set of owners." Well, before making its way to its final resting place, a steel vault in Tokyo, and being available to everyone online, number 45 affected the lives of those who owned it. No one parted with the book willingly. Death, bankruptcy, and other disasters forced owners to sell it. Davis declares it seems as though ownership of number 45 requires prepayment in tragedy. Similarly, the book's value was always shifting as wars and other events devastated some national economies and helped others flourish. While number 45 is always at the center of Davis's writing, the book can be seen online, but Davis describes it with beauty and accuracy, interweaving the descriptions throughout the book in a way that gives readers a sense of knowing, of having experienced number 45 themselves. Here's another quote. "Number 45's illuminations are one of its distinguishing features, as it is one of the few Gutenberg Bibles illustrated in Mans, where it was printed. Its floral motifs are naturalistic, its lines elongated and slender, and the range of color is narrow, bright green and light pink, contrasting with pale gray, red, and rarely blue." The Lost Gutenberg pulls readers into a five-century saga, plunging them into the minds of those who desired the Bible and the prestige that came with it. Well, this makes it a book about not only number 45 and its owners, but also a narrative that explores our collective obsession with art, technology, change, and history. Davis manages to recount how Johannes Gutenberg's invention changed the world and how his Bibles became crowning jewels in some of the most important private art and book collections of the past five centuries. But perhaps the best summary of what number 45 means to culture in general is something written by Mark Twain. In the last paragraph of a manuscript essay, Twain wrote to officials of the Gutenberg Museum in Mans in 1900, the year the museum opened. The author of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and its sequel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, stated, "What the world is today, good and bad, it owes to Gutenberg. Everything can be traced to this source, but we are bound to bring him homage for what he said in dreams to the angered angel and has been literally fulfilled. For the bad that his colossal invention has brought about is overshadowed 1,000 times by the good with which mankind has been favored." This is a fascinating book, I think, and I think you'll enjoy it. Many have already at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. This is called The Lost Gutenberg by Margaret Leslie Davis. Now we'll turn back to a novel. This one is called The View from Rain Shadow Bay by Colleen Coble. Here's the plot. After her husband Jack dies in a climbing incident, Shauna has only her 5-year-old son and her helicopter charter business to live for. Every day is a struggle to make ends meet, and she lives in constant fear of losing even more than she already has. When her business partner is murdered, his final words convince Shauna that she's in danger too. But where can she turn? Zach Bannister was her husband's best friend and is the person she blames for his death. She's barely spoken to him since, but right now he seems her only hope for protecting her son. Zach is only too happy to assuage his guilt over Jack's death by helping Shauna any way he can. But there are secrets involved dating back to Shauna's childhood that more than one person would prefer to stay hidden. In The View from Rain Shadow Bay, suspense, danger, and a longing to love again ignite amid the gorgeous lavender fields of Washington State. Again, that book is called The View from Rain Shadow Bay by Colleen Coble. Here's another very popular author that's come out with a relatively new book here. This is Cemetery Road by Greg Iles. When Marshall McKeown left his Mississippi hometown at 18, he vowed never to return. The trauma that drove him away spurred him to become one of the most successful journalists in Washington, D.C. But as the ascendancy of a chaotic administration lifts him from print fame to television stardom, Marshall discovers that his father is terminally ill and he must return home to face the unfinished business of the past. On arrival, he finds Bienville, Mississippi, very much changed. His family's 150-year-old newspaper business is failing, and Jet Turner, the love of his youth, has married into the family of Max Matheson, one of a dozen powerful patriarchs who rule the town through the exclusive Bienville Poker Club. To Marshall's surprise, the poker club has taken a town on the brink of extinction and offered it salvation in the form of a $1 billion Chinese paper mill. But on the verge of the deal being consummated, two murders rock Bienville to its core, threatening far more than the city's economic future. Another great book by the very popular mystery writer Greg Iles. That one is called Cemetery Road. And that's just about all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search for North Carolina Library for the Blind. You can also call toll-free at 1-888-388-2460. That's 1-888-388-2460. Now, you can also use these same numbers and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, and it is that wonderful organization that sponsors this monthly feature all about books here on the North Carolina Reading Service. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after this broadcast at our website, which is now TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time, and thanks for listening.